Judiciary Committee, February 4th, 1:30 p.m., room 350.
Committee will come to order. Clerk will note those members present, the balance are absent. House Bill 2252, William Martin.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is William C. Martin, 2908 First National Bank Tower in Portland. I'm Secretary of Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar and a member of the Oregon Bar. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Bar in support of House Bill 2252. Oregon liberalized the joinder statute, however, with a few minor exceptions, they still are problems of what you do when you join actions, and you have the problem of decisions being made by the court prior to the final decision and whether or not these are appealable determinations. This bill seeks to permit appeals prior to the final determination of all the matters that may come before the court in a complicated proceeding in which there will be decisions made before the final decision. Federal Rule 54B addresses itself to this problem, and with a history of 63 years of interpretation of similar rules in the federal court, 54B should be very helpful if Oregon decides to adopt a procedure permitting appeals prior to final determination of the entire proceeding. This would require some revision of existing statutes. ORS 18.010, which defines judgment and decrees, should be amended to include final judgments entered in multiple party and multiple claim litigation prior to a final determination of the entire proceeding. The Summary Judgment Act, ORS 18.105, should be amended to make clear that summary judgment determinations prior to the complete disposition of all claims are appealable if entered in accordance with House Bill 2252. ORS 18.130, which permits judgments against one or more parties in multiple party actions, would be superseded by House Bill 2252 and could be repealed. ORS 19.010 defines appealable judgments and would be amended to include final judgments in multiple party and multiple claim actions entered in accordance with House Bill 2252. The entry of an appealable judgment prior to the final disposition of multiple party and multiple claim proceedings would require, before it would be a determination and therefore appealable, an express finding by the court that there is no just reason for delay and an express direction for entry of the judgment so that there can be no doubt of the court's intention to enter a final appealable judgment. I might say there is some doubt, and we have had some problems, and the Supreme Court has had some problems, determining whether a decision by the court in a prior to final determination might or might not be appealable. This statute specifically requires the entry by the court of a determination that it is a final judgment and is therefore appealable. So there isn't anything to interpret. The judge makes that determination. This is now a part of the federal rules, 54B, from which this was derived. House Bill 2252 would also permit the court to stay execution of the judgment until the entry of such of subsequent judgments in the proceeding. This also might be necessary where executions prior to the final determination could, in some case, be somewhat unfair and unreasonable because people didn't know where they stood. The court could stay the execution until the final determination of all the matters if the court felt and a showing was made that that would be appropriate. We recommend the adoption of this legislation not only because of the efficiency of an immediate appeal upon early disposition of claims in multiple claim and multiple party proceedings, but also because this legislation clarifies and simplifies the procedures in these proceedings for filing appeals as well as cost bills and supersedious bonds. Under Oregon's current procedure, a judgment may be entered against one of several defendants under ORS 18.130 or on a counterclaim or cross-claim in a summary judgment, and it is possible the prevailing party may execute on the party against whom the judgment is entered, who may not even stay such proceedings because a supersedious bond may only be filed after an appeal, and appeal may only be taken after entry of a final judgment. So we do have a problem of somebody not being able to even protect themselves by an appeal at the present time unless we have some proceeding to clarify what happens in these multiple party and multiple claim proceedings, particularly in the summary judgment area. On the other side of the question is whether appellate courts should be burdened with piecemeal appeals. The Oregon Constitution provides Supreme Court shall have jurisdiction only to revise the final decisions of the circuit courts. We do not believe that this legislation violates this constitutional provision, since our court has already approved appeals where cost bills, accounting, and attorney's fees remain to be determined. We also do not believe House Bill 2252 permits piecemeal appeals. If Oregon's procedure permits joinder of several claims and parties, then denial of a right to appeal judgments entered before all claims are determined would deny to a litigant a right he would have had if the joinder had never been authorized. Joinder does not mean all causes are heard in one trial, and it should likewise not necessarily require all appeals be decided in one second or appellate court argument. For these reasons, I recommend adoption of this legislation.
I received a letter, a copy of which was sent to the bar, raising some concern about the perhaps unintended effect of this bill in terms of, I think, joinder. I believe it was 2252. I thought I had the letter
with me. There are two joinder bills that are the next two bills.
Well, perhaps I've got the wrong...
Maybe I don't know the letter you're talking about. They are two joinder bills that are the next two bills.
I don't know what I tried to find it. Mr. Minson, do you recall getting that? Oh, you have it. All right.
I have it here.
Which bill did that relate to? It's connected. All right. I wasn't sure. Questions of Mr. Martin? Representative Frommeyer?
Yes. Mr. Martin, could you clarify for me again where the original draft of this bill came from? Is this an exact copy of the federal statute?
It was. I participated in the drafting, so I can tell you how it was done. Federal Rule 52B was used as the model for the bill.
54B,
I'm sorry. 54B. Was used as the model, obviously, because we have a different situation because we have equity suits and law actions and so forth. Some of the wording had to be modified, and also we already have some legislation which was not addressed to by the federal bill, and that presently existing laws had to be modified so as to conform with the bill. But except for those kind of modifications, it is 54B.
Mr. Chairman, another question.
Representative Frommeyer.
Martin, I am hardly the world's greatest expert on civil procedure, but I have wondered about the effect of this, which in effect, I guess, is an interlocutory appeal, or at least it might look like it, on existing doctrines such as collateral estoppel. Let's say where the party has pleaded alternative causes of action. If you go up for a final judgment on one aspect of this, what would be the effect of that judgment on an existing but not yet final judgment in the lawsuit?
Excuse me, it's my understanding of the law of collateral estoppel that there would be a collateral estoppel even though there's a pending appeal. Now, that's my understanding of the application of that a appeal doesn't change the effect of collateral estoppel. I had occasion at one time, I think, to go into that matter, and I was satisfied that was the case, that the fact you have appealed doesn't mean there is outstanding a decision which could collaterally stop the action. Now, whether a court would choose to postpone a decision until that appeal was made would be something that would be made. But I mean, even if you have independent action, the fact that you have appealed doesn't mean that the decision of the lower court couldn't collaterally stop some other action. Even if you're not talking about complicated actions, you're talking about a simple action and seeking to use the lower court's decision to collateral estoppel in a separate proceeding.
Yeah, I guess my concern then is this: suppose you had in the one suit a number of theories of action brought by the plaintiff. Defendant gets a favorable verdict with respect to one of those, runs up to the appellate court. Or the plaintiff does, if he's stupid enough, I guess, and receives an adverse judgment, then that wipes out the rest of the lawsuit, arguably, doesn't it?
Well, I think that type of an effect, I think, could happen, and I think that might be a very desirable effect. In other words, other words, to try them all in the lower court when they're all going to be reversed or all going to be determined by the decision of the appeal on the first one would seem to me to be desirable.
Well, my point is, though, that from the standpoint of the party bringing the action, it may not be the most favorable ground on which he's brought the suit that first gets to the appellate court.
That could be a problem. If he hoped to have a better set of facts for a court to consider in determining what the law was, there would be that danger, I suppose, yes.
Okay. Is the treatment of summary judgment in sub 7, the new sub 7, which dovetails it into the certification procedure for purposes of permitting an appeal, is that the same way the summary judgment in multi-party cases is handled in federal court?
That's what's intended, yes, as I understand it is.
Further questions? Representative Bugis?
Maybe you said something to this when you were giving your statement. I'm sorry, I didn't get it. What did the judges think of this, generally?
Our next witness is a judge.
Okay,
yeah.
Maybe
he's the one to write that question. I just have not consulted with judges in writing it, nor have I consulted with them concerning what their opinion is.
What, in your opinion, do you think it will have any effect on avoiding multiple appeals or cutting down caseloads, you know, by resolving the matter, such as in the case that you...
I think there are situations where if you can appeal the first determination by a court, which is final judgment, you might dispose of all the rest of the litigation. I mean, Representative Frommeyer raised the question of whether you really want to do that, but I think it's conceivable you can have that effect. I personally would kind of think that might be desirable, certainly from a caseload standpoint. But it would have be fraught with the problems of those who said, I would rather have my case go up first. But that's always a risk if you had separate actions, if somebody will get to the Supreme Court and decide the law before you get there with what you think is a better case.
Further questions? Representative Rutherford?
Yes, Mr. Martin, at present there's some difficulty, is there not, regarding appeals when the judge has ruled on a demur, as to whether or not the judge's order is appealable, and the plaintiff is then put to his own peril in selecting what he's
there. There are several areas, the one we're talking about, where the litigant himself does not know, should I appeal now, or if I appeal, what is it going to mean, or if I get to the Supreme Court, is he going to say I didn't have any right to appeal now? This would completely be cured by this bill, because the court, the lower court itself, will say this is a final order, and by saying that, they will say this is appealable, and when they say that, it is an appealable decision. So right now, we do have doubts in several areas where you may or may not be able to appeal, and you do so at your own peril.
Do you think that this bill would provide a fairer method of determining that? Those kinds of questions than
well,
the existing statute?
I think certainly just having everyone in doubt cannot be a good state of the law, and this eliminates doubt, and therefore I would think it would be good.
Further questions?
Okay.
Representative Lombard.
So as I understand it, there's a great deal of latitude then given to the trial judge in this case, is there and is there not, in determining or in designating what is a final order or final judgment?
That's right. You could have that latitude, and failure to say it was an appealable order would mean it wasn't.
Do you have any feeling for or any idea? I realize it's very hard to guesstimate something like this, just what we might be looking at in terms of increased appeals if we had this provision?
I would think it might very well reduce appeals and would reduce the burden on the court. I would think that if the court can decide something early in the game, they might postpone the trial, which might be very complicated after some early issue was determined, say as to one of the parties. put that party out of the litigation, you might very well postpone a long, complicated litigation, because having determined that party is out and having appealed that and decided that they are clear out of the picture, the rest of the case could be settled and disposed of very quickly, and a long trial could be averted.
Further questions?
No.
I'd just like to make one comment.
Representative Rutherford?
I just wanted to commend you, Mr. Martin, on your testimony today. We've had a number of bills here from the bar, and I think this has probably been the best presentation, most illuminating that we've had.
Martin, do you have a copy of the statement that you made?
I do, and I have given it to the Secretary.
Thank you. Judge Beatty?
Members of the committee, John Beatty, 2958 Southwest Dodge Road, Cortland, representing the Judicial Conference. Please follow my former partner, unbeknownst to him or me. At this point, I only want to make one or two brief comments. First of all, the Judicial Conference takes no position with respect to this bill, nor with respect to 2252 or 2253, the joinder bills. I have discussed it with Judge Dale, who is chairman of the Judicial Conference Procedure and Practice Committee, and I think in general, our view is that the critical factor, we think, is the procedural counsel bill. What we are concerned with, as year after year, we are bringing in portions of the federal rules and modifications of federal rules, is that they are tend to be brought in the course of the legislative process without, despite the best efforts, the best questions that are asked, without a full detailed discussion of the interplay between one part of the system and the other. When you start affecting one part, you may inadvertently affect another. And one thing which we have observed in Multnomah County, and I think that both Judge Dale and Judge Olson, who have been presiding judges there, have commented on over the last 4 or 5 years, is that the litigation is becoming much more complicated. And sometimes we are given certain assignments, new assignments by procedural amendments, without the necessary procedural tools to handle. So, all I would say with respect to this bill and the joinder bills is that I would ask you to bear in mind that the importance of considering and I hope passing the procedural counsel bill, which will provide a continuing forum in which these things can be ironed out without the necessity of sort of flying blind on them. With respect to what effect it will have on appeals, I simply don't know. I'm not well enough informed. I will undertake to talk to and get an immediate response from the Chief Justice on that as to whether or not the Supreme Court has any opinion on it. And if we have any advice, I'll provide it promptly to the committee.
Thank you, Judge.
All right.
I might say that, as you may know, last session the House reasonably strongly approved the meaningful version of the Council on Court Procedure Bill. In fact, I think it did it twice. And the problem seemed to lie with the upper house, as they say. And I'm hopeful that the House will again look favorably on it.
I think that, I agree with you, Representative Myers, in the long run, that's going to save an awful lot of time for this committee, and I think we'll avoid an awful lot of problems if we can get that through this session.
I might say, too, though, Judge, on the merits of this particular proposal, I am familiar through federal practice. This particular feature has been a part of the federal rules for many, many years, and as far as I know, has worked quite smoothly, and I have no reason to think it, at this point at least, it should not be a part of our code, but anyway. Representative Rutherford?
Judge, you indicated initially that the judicial conference had adopted no position on the bill, but then you raised several questions regarding amendments coming in piecemeal and amendments without tools, and I wondered if those comments were to be construed as directed toward this bill in a favorable fashion.
I'm not, frankly, in a position to express an opinion. I don't have a personal opinion on it because I have to get the amount of study, for example, that Mr. Martin's given, at least from his point of view. And I'm not in a position to say whether I think will have any effect on the appellate process at this point.
So I take it your comments, really were dicta.
They're not even dicta. They're a general observation so that you'll understand our concern with the general proposition. Not designed to be a roundabout way of saying no with respect to this bill.
Mr. Martin, Representative Kulongoski. Thank you, Judge. Representative Kulongoski has a question, I believe.
Mr. Martin, at the bar committee, what was the vote on this particular bill? Was it unanimous?
My recollection is it was unanimous. Do you have any different recollection?
I believe it was.
I might say one other thing, and I don't want this to be misunderstood in any way, but our committee, the Decision Practice Committee, does have a member of the Supreme Court sit as an observer. He does not vote, and I wouldn't want to anyway imply that they approve or disapprove, but there is some input and counterplay in this procedure so that at least the Supreme Court does have some knowledge of what our committee is doing.
At the bar convention, when this was brought up on the floor, was there any opposition to it?
Now, I was not present when this was brought up on the floor of the bar convention. I was there. I don't recall anybody speaking here because I don't think the vote was unanimous there. The worst one knows.
You
break
the
law
call
in
the opposition.
I've been through this enough to know that we will never see the opponents of the bill, and I just want to know who they are if I can, just to be able to identify them.
In drafting it, I ran into none of the opponents, or in looking around for people who had comments on it, I found none of them.
They always see the surface in the Senate, though. I never have understood that.
Well, after the bills have cleared the House, if you'll just hang around in the corridor outside the Senate Judiciary Committee, you can start recognizing Representative Kulongoski. House Bill 2253. I can't read the name.
That's me.
Is that Mr. Martin again? It is, but that's a letter.
Okay. I've already given you that I'm appearing here at the Oregon State Bar, and I am William C. Martin, and I am also appearing in support of House Bill 2253. 2253 is intended to permit a plaintiff to join all claims he has against the defendant in one action. Oregon has long had restrictive rules regarding joinder of claims. ORF 16.220, the present joinder statute, lists categories of claims that may be joined, and all the claims must fall into one of these categories for joinder to be allowed. These categories are generally derived from the common law forms of action. In 1973, the legislature significantly liberalized ORF 16.220 by authorizing joinder when the claims arise out of the same transaction or transactions or occurrences. However, because of the continued use of categories, joinder of claims falling into different categories is still prohibited unless the claims arise out of the same transactions or occurrences. Because of the amendment to the counterclaim statute by the 75 legislature, there is now an inconsistency in Oregon law. A defendant can join in an answer any counterclaims he may have against the plaintiff without regard to the category or type of claim. But the plaintiff is restricted in the types of claims that may be joined to their all being within the one category. House Bill 2253 would remove this inconsistency by allowing a plaintiff to join any claims the plaintiff has against the defendant subject to the jurisdictional requirements of the court. This is the procedure followed in many other states and in the federal courts. The proposed legislation is somewhat similar to Federal Rule 18.
If joinder would be prejudicial or inconvenient or cause undue expense or delay, the court has authority under ORS 11.060 to order the claims to be separated for trial. The bill would permit one trial, where now several would be required. It would, to that extent, reduce the caseload in the court. I would recommend its adoption.
Questions?
Are there any other witnesses on this bill, or is Mr. Martin?
Larry Kirkpatrick from the University of Boise. Mr. Chairman, I believe, of the Practice and Procedure Committee at the Bar. Why don't you come up, Larry?
I just see Mr. Martin's feet.
Yeah, what did you say for them, Bill?
I didn't mean to cut Mr. Martin off, but what I was wondering is if the defense bar had a position or if there was an opposing point of view on this.
No, he's not going to take a different point of view.
I'm just saying it's part
of it also. Representative Kiwangoski's remarks were not facetious.
Pardon me?
About how the opposition seems to surface on these.
I see. I thought perhaps Mr. Martin, through his committee, maybe there were some members of the defense bar there who might have some comments on this joinder, or were there none?
My own comment?
Through the Procedure and Practice Committee, or through your other contacts, have you had contact with the defense bar, who I take it would be most likely to be those opposed to this amendment?
Well, again, I think our committee is fairly well divided between defense and plaintiff's counsel. I, again, am sure there was some comments in opposition, but I don't remember any strong opposition to this bill. Do you?
I don't recall any strong opposition. Also, there may have been one or two dissenting votes on the committee. Some persons have general... I'm Larry Kirkpatrick of the Procedure and Practice Committee. Some members of the committee have general reservations about adopting any of the federal rules, and this, of course, is based on Federal Rule 18, so some attorneys may have reservations simply based on that fact. But I don't think there was substantial opposition because the concept of expanding joinder has been relatively well accepted. The bar has introduced two bills, as Mr. Martin indicated, at the 1973 session, the bill to expand joiner substantially by allowing all claims to be joined if they arise out of the same cause of action. And then at the 1975 legislature, the bar recommended and this committee adopted legislation to allow joinder of legal and equitable claims. So we have almost complete joinder now in complaints of all types of claims. It's just there are still a certain number of circumstances for no particularly good reason that cannot be joined in complaints. So that's why the committee and the bar are recommending simply going the full way and allowing joinder of any claims that the plaintiff has against the defendant.
I think if you were going to find opposition, you'd probably find it based upon people saying you could have totally different claims that might be introduced from prejudice in one area in a different claim that was joined with it. And I would suppose people who would be opposed on that basis. I think there are sufficient safeguards to avoid that. Obviously, you can have separate trials where that exists, and I think there'd be areas where it could be improper for a court not to permit separate trials. But basically, I think attorneys generally, with that exception, would be much more inclined to favor not having a series of trials over things that could be disposed of in one trial.
Representative Frommeyer?
Yeah, I have two questions, Mr. Chairman. First one is the language of this proposed provision close enough to Federal Rule 18 that cases construing that rule would be applicable to as persuasive authority with respect to this one?
That is my understanding. I did not assist in drafting it. I was on the committee and participated in the discussions. That was my understanding, and my reading of the bill and what knowledge I have of Rule 18 would seem to indicate that to me.
Would Professor Kirkpatrick address himself to that?
That's a correct statement. Section Part 1 of Section 2 of the bill is virtually identical to Federal Rule 18. Section 2 and 3 are just taken from the Oregon Joinder Provision, ORS 16220, the language about having to be tried in the same county and requiring them to be separately stated. That's simply part of the existing Oregon statute. This also is retained in the new amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, go ahead.
Final question. That is, in the at least this statute does not define claim, the word claim. do you think that that is necessary, or do you think that the word has a sufficiently commonly understood definition that in the cases and elsewhere that, that is not needed?
Of course, that claim does come from, obviously, the federal rule. I would not think so, because I think claims does have a recognized definition in the law, particularly when you look at the history of this statute, you can go to the federal rules and just find a definition, I think, in decided cases.
That does
also, the system is legal or equitable. Go ahead. I would not think that would be required. That's your
existing law.
Well, the state language, the language of state cases and the state statute generally is in terms of cause of action, whereas the federal rules speak in terms of claims for relief because of the difficulty of defining what a cause of action is. But it seems from the federal case law that the federal courts have had as much trouble defining what a claim for relief is as the state courts have in defining what a cause of action is. So I'm not sure it would make any difference if we use the more traditional cause of action. I think the committee's feeling it would be better to just stay consistent with the federal wording so that there'd be no question that the federal case law could be used in interpreting this joinder statute.
Yeah. Dennis here just pointed me out that ORS 16.220, dealing with the existing statute with joinder, uses three subsections that have the word claims, but it also uses the word injuries, also uses the word contract. And I guess what's in the back of my mind is how many people are going to have to go to an appellate court to pay their attorney's fees before there is a common understanding about the meaning of this, or am I worried about a problem that's non-existent?
I wouldn't see how it could present a problem in the sense that it's unlimited. If it were placing some limit, then there could be an argument about whether the joinder is permissible. But given that it allows unlimited joinder of the claims that are available, whether there are two claims there or four, in either case, they could be joined under the statute if there is permissive joinder. So I would think the problem that you're raising might only apply if there were some limit here, and then it would question whether this fell within the limits. In fact, the point you're raising is exactly the reason why we're proposing the amendment, because the existing statute talks in terms of do all your claims fall in one of these categories of 16-20, and there is conflict and dispute about whether all the claims fit in one of those categories. So that's basically the impetus behind this proposal to do away with these categories and to fit yourself in a slot and simply allow a joinder of whatever claims you may have.
I think claims are better word than the ones currently used. To that extent, maybe it's...
We hope perhaps if we get our counsel that one of the new rules will be to adopt the concept of claim for relief, single claim for relief. Larry, I'd like you to deal with that letter. Is there... I don't think the members of the committee have it. Would you mind just quickly reading it to us and responding if there is any basis for the concern there?
Okay, I'd be glad to read the letter. This is from George Jennings, an attorney with the law firm of MacArthur and Horner in Monmouth, to Representative Myers. Dear Representative Myers, in reviewing House Bill 2253, which proposes to repeal ORS 16220 and replace it with a new section, we have found what may turn out to be a rather substantial problem. Under present law, we are able to join separate causes of action against separate defendants which arise out of the same transaction, citing various Oregon statutes and cases. We recognize the problem which the bar is intending to eliminate by passage of House Bill 2253, namely the present inability of a plaintiff to join several unrelated causes of action against a single defendant. However, the proposed legislation would apparently return us to the antiquated rule which necessitated relitigating the same issue in several different trials, citing the McGrath case, 258 Oregon 583. We do not profess to be proficient in the area of bill drafting, therefore cannot recommend amendments to House Bill 2253, but we would certainly hope that this possible problem would be cleared up prior to its passage. Thank you for considering your comments. I spoke to Mr. Jennings over the telephone to identify what aspect of the bill was presenting this concern, and apparently the basis of the concern is the repeal of 16220, because 16220 is a rather unusual statute. Most states in the federal rules break their joinder provisions into one statute governing joinder of claims and one statute governing joinder of parties. However, 16220, which is basically a joinder of claims statute, also has a provision in Part 2 that has been construed as authorizing joinder of parties to some extent. And so Mr. Jennings' concern was that by repealing 16220 entirely,
there'd also be this repeal of the provision that allows joining of parties in subsection 2 of 16220. The committee's response to that is that we felt that part 2 of 16220 would be unnecessary if 2254 is adopted. In other words, the approach we're taking is to recommend a new, more expansive joinder of claim statutes and a separate and more expansive joinder of party statute. So if the joinder of party statute is adopted, the problem Mr. Jennings identifies wouldn't exist. However, I think he's correct that you'd have to adopt, the committee should probably consider adopting both bills together, or else a problem would arise, because if this bill does repeal the joint of parties provision 16220, so the bar is presenting them to the committee as a package.
Let's take a look at the further questions on 2253.
I had one question.
Representative Rutherford.
So that the record is clear when this case is appealed. In section 1, or pardon me, in paragraph 1 of section 2, there is a statement that the as many claims legal or equitable. By the use of the word or, do you intend to create a division between the claims that can be filed? In other words, must all legal claims be filed together and all equitable claims be filed together? Or may legal and equitable claims be filed in the same complaint?
I'm glad you're giving us an opportunity to make the legislative history clear on that point. It is the intent of the committee not to go back to the traditional rule that was rejected by the 75 legislature of requiring all legal claims or all equitable claims. Perhaps the phrasing should have been and or, but that's not a phrasing we wanted to use. But the intent of the committee was that it could have a mixture of legal and equitable claims in the joinder provision. If there's some other way to word that, I think our committee would be receptive to amendment that would avoid that ambiguity or make the Supreme Court case unnecessary if you feel that is an ambiguity in the statute.
I just say
legal and equitable is my answer to eliminate the problem.
I just wanted to be sure I see the tape recorders running.
Well, if we think there's a problem that can be corrected by amendment, that probably is the way to go as opposed to just dealing with it in legislative history. Representative Bugis?
Do you intend, maybe Mr. Martin can answer this, I don't know, but I understand you're interested in the drafting of this too and the rationale of it behind it.
Mr. Barr, why don't you just stay on up here? It looks like you're going to be on 2254 also.
Sorry, I just didn't hear.
A couple of things. Do you, maybe I misunderstood the comment in that letter, and it raised a question that I thought maybe had been answered by earlier conversation, but now I'm not sure. Do you intend to combine causes of action or claims only arising out of the same cause of action?
Combine all
claims.
Does
it make any difference?
No.
As long as you got the same two parties?
Right.
Okay. Claims or causes of action.
Yeah,
you make no distinction.
Yes, claims is intended to certainly cover causes of action and
okay.
Causes of suit and everything, yes.
Further questions?
Secondly, if this is the case, you made a comment earlier that you felt that it would, I think, lower the number of cases filed, which I have to agree with if we pass it. Will it actually shorten your court time? Is it probable that you will continue to, you're going to try the same case? You'll have probably only one jury, maybe in several claims or several causes.
Well, I don't think there's any question. If you can join several claims in one lawsuit, that it takes less time to try several cases in one lawsuit than it does to try several lawsuits. I mean,
But wouldn't you run into problems, for instance, on your right of appeal? Wouldn't you maybe have two, let's assume you had two different claims or two different causes of action combined. One, just for a little more clarity in my troubled thought, because I'm not really a practitioner of law, but wouldn't you have trouble on appeal, let's say, if one side won both an equity and a law case tried under this statute and wanted to appeal both of them, would you really accomplish anything then by combining the two? Wouldn't you make for worse law in the lower court?
Well, I would not think so. I think we get worse law when we try a series of related claims in different lawsuits than we do if we try them all in the same lawsuit.
But do all your claims and your cause of action have to arise out of the same incident?
Not under this, any claim that you have.
So you could have different sets of witnesses, completely different sets of witnesses,
right,
with regard to each issue that might arise.
Right.
The only thing you need in common are the two, the same plaintiffs and the same defendant, right?
All the hassles you have in the defendant, you can settle on one trial.
One other thing occurs to me, Mr. Chairman, if I can continue. Do you have any possible problems, since I noticed you talked about forcible entry of detainers and rental action, are there any insurance problems with this? Does this complicate life with regard to getting insurance, which would insurance coverage raise questions here that we're not looking for?
I suppose what you're raising is some of the claims might be defended by an insurance policy, and therefore you'd have attorneys for the insurance company on part of the and someone else on the other one. I'm sure that would be true in instances. That's true now under our present procedure where they involved in the same occurrence. There are cases where an insurance covers part of it and doesn't cover the rest of it. That's true right now.
But this would have no adverse impact on, for instance, an insurance company or some other individual who would want to appeal, let's say, the result of the lower court.
I certainly would think not. And particularly if we go back to 2252, where there can be separate appeals from, and earlier appeals even from, the determinations in the joined claims, it would seem to me that there would be no serious problem involved in that.
If I may comment on that, I think the concern about that issue may be resolved by ORS 11.060 that would allow a judge to sever the trial if there ever became a problem. If anybody would be put to a disadvantage by trying the claims together, a defendant can ask the judge to sever them for trial. So really all this does is allow the plaintiff to try to join them if the plaintiff wants to. There'll be many cases where the plaintiff might feel it would be too complex and would rather try them in separate lawsuits, but if the plaintiff feels they can be effectively tried together, the plaintiff has the option to join them in the complaint, and then as to whether they can actually be tried together depends on whether the defendant objects and persuades the judge that would be too cumbersome. If he does, then the judge can order them tried separately, even though they're allowed at the joinder stage and the pleadings to be brought together.
Yeah, I realize either party could, if I can continue, Mr. Chairman, either party could ask for, I suppose, some kind of a separation of the things. But let's assume we pass both this one and the next case, the next bill. I can foresee the possibility of sort of gang fights. You combine parties, you combine causes. Is this not happening anywhere where you have these statutes and things?
I'm sure that it does require a judge who is capable of setting forth what the issues are that can be tried together and what ones can't, and lining up the schedule accordingly. I have a lot of confidence in our courts and their ability to do that sort of thing. Better than not being able to do it and being forced to have a bunch of separate trials because there's no other alternative.
You said even if Judge Brady were here. Further questions? Let's take 2254 then. It looks like you're on there too.
My name is William C. Martin for your record here. Primarily, 2254 is intended to permit several plaintiffs to join the plaintiffs in an action or suit where they are seeking to recover for their individual claims arising out of the same transaction or occurrence. It's broader than that, but I think that's one of the primary things we've accomplished. The 1975 legislature amended ORS 13.160, intending to achieve this result. Unfortunately, 13.160 allows joinder only of plaintiffs having an interest in the subject of further action and in obtaining the relief demanded. Courts in other states construing similar language have held that if the plaintiffs are seeking separate recovery of damages, they do not have an interest in obtaining the relief demanded and therefore cannot be joined. No Oregon appellate case has yet construed 13.160, but there is significant danger that it will not accomplish its intended purpose of authorizing permissive joinder of parties and actions at law. House Bill 2254 is based upon Federal Rule 20, the Federal Joinder of Parties provision. It thus has the advantage of a substantial body of federal case law construing the provision. The proposed legislation authorizes the joinder of plaintiffs if they assert any right to relief severally or in the alternative in respect to or arising out of the same transaction, occurrence, or series of transactions or occurrences, and if any question of law or fact common to all these persons will arise in the action. The bill also addresses another problem of joinder. Under existing Oregon law, if a plaintiff is uncertain which of two defendants is responsible for the plaintiff's injuries, it is generally not possible to sue the defendants in the alternative. House Bill 2254 authorizes the assertion of claims against defendants in the alternative. The bill should result in the consolidation of claims into one trial instead of two or three. It is permissive, so no plaintiff would be required to join. I would recommend its adoption. I might say in regard to this alternative procedure, this is a terrible dilemma. If you have alternative defendants, it's certainly possible now to sue in separate types of actions and find that you come out with no judgment against either of them because each claims it was the other. And there is that possibility, which I think would certainly mitigate towards saying you should have that type of procedure in that particular situation.
Does this depart in any significant way from the wording of the federal rule?
No, it does not. It's virtually verbatim, except for adding equitable suits, I believe, the language. Adding the words or suit, otherwise, I think it's verbatim from the federal rule.
Questions on 2254? Did you have anything to add,
I think Mr. Martin covered everything I was going to testify on that bill.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative from
Just a question, Mr. Martin. Might we have a copy of your testimony? Can you give me a copy of your testimony to the committee clerk? Thank you.
We'll have a staff distribute that to everybody before they come up to the work session. 2255, Burl Green. I noticed there are, Donald Dunn is here also from the bar. Would you like to come up with Burl?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Burl Green. I practice law in Portland and Jackson Towers, and I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar Practice and Procedure Committee. Fortunately, they assigned what I consider a relatively simple bill to me. Currently, what we're really talking about is what is going to go to the jury at the termination of the trial. And the current statute says pleading and exhibits. Now, I think we all recognize that the practice of law, particularly litigation, has become far too expensive. One of the reasons it's expensive is because of the preliminary matters that go on before a trial actually takes place. And in our procedure in the state of Oregon, primarily the preliminary matters are motion practice. The motion practice, we feel, will be greatly eliminated if the pleadings are not going to go to the jury. If it eliminates motions such as matters being repetitious in the complaint or answer, it would eliminate matters that language might be unjustifiably prejudicial, such as describing injuries as grievous injuries, describing the accident or collision as a powerful impact. All those things would be you wouldn't worry about. And so you will not be coming to the courthouse on every one of your cases and having to charge your clients money for doing it. That's really the sole purpose of this bill, is to eliminate that motion. It won't eliminate it, but to greatly decrease the motion practice and save the clients money.
Oh, Burl, I'd get to put the union bug back on the pleading paper.
I asked you an earlier question. I think that nobody's going to surface that I know of a set of sight on these bills. I'm usually the one that is nitpicking with this particular committee on something about bills that they want. I'm probably down here Monday on one that this committee's proposing I'm opposed to.
Did the committee, your committee, consider just abolishing dilatory motions altogether?
No, not since I've been on it. This is my third year. My second time around, my third year.
Mr. Chairman, dilatory motions are in the eyes of the beholder, I believe.
I think what you're asking, did we consider...
Wait, put it this way, did you consider doing that in conjunction with this?
No, sir. We did not consider it. In the last 3 years, the question of the federal system of motion practice has not been considered by our committee. As you know, the motions are in the federal practice. They're very... not used very much.
At least by any lawyers who know anything about the judges in Portland. So it's fun to see the one who doesn't, who walks in. The first time a motion to strike or whatever they've got in the federal rules. Questions on 2255. Is this the same bill we passed last session?
It's
58 to nothing or something in the House. Never heard of again in the Senate.
The only objection was not from any outside lawyers, it was from one of the senators.
It was all the visible opposition that bothered me.
Representative from there.
I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry, I thought it was...
Mr. Chairman.
Question
now, just so I get my thinking straight, actually what you do as a matter of practice is run in before the charge to the jury move that they not be allowed to take the plea, right? If you do it as a matter of law.
No, sir, what happens is, say I'm representing the plaintiff, which I do, and I file a complaint and the defendant doesn't like some of my language because they figure it might be inflammatory so far as a juror reading that language that I put in the complaint. So they file a motion saying that they move to strike that particular language. We have to go up and argue before a judge. This is long before the trial. You spend the time, maybe with the fifth or sixth motion down the line. So you're spending an hour or 2 hours up there. And just to strike a few silly words that I put in the complaint and shouldn't have put in there in the first place, probably. But this way, since the pleadings will not go to the jury will never see those words, and so it isn't going to make any difference. The defendant isn't going to worry about it. He's not going to file his motion.
Does your committee consider any requirement with respect to something like or a pretrial order, which would constitute some statement of issues superseding the pleadings?
Not in the last 3 years. If you go through the practice and procedure, proposals and discussions over the years, those have been considered.
I know they're being used by some judges now. I think in and out of Multnomah County. But. Further questions?
Chairman.
Representative Lombard.
I just, it seems to me, and I don't want to be misconstruing things here, but it seems to me with this series of bills, we're doing exactly what Judge Beatty mentioned in the first bill, and that is just a piecemeal adoption of the federal rules. That's pretty much it.
Not this. I can see, and I would agree with you on the first three, that is a potential danger. But this bill is entirely separate. This is just really a housekeeping thing. The attorney's fee has nothing to do with the federal rules one way or the other.
No, but I realize that, but I believe in your own testimony, you were saying that you could probably, as a plaintiff's counsel, back off from some of your attractive language in the pleading that you might try to slip in for the jury's eyes and defendants likewise, and pretty well limit your pleadings, pretty well simplify the pleadings, almost going to a straight federal rules notice type pleading.
Well, you still have to state your cause of action or state procedure. All I'm trying to say, Mr. Representative, is that I don't think this is an adoption of a federal rule at all. It has nothing to do with it. Now, if you're talking about notice pleading, that's something entirely different. This is not, all this is saying is what you do plead, the jury doesn't see unless it's made an exhibit. That's all it says. And that's nothing to do pro or con federal rules.
Mr. Chairman, could I intercede at this point? My name is Donald Dunn. I also am a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee. I'm from the Dalles. I I feel it's unfortunate when a bill is tagged as a federal rule or it's the adoption of the federal rules. We on the committee try to pick the best, and if it happens to be similar to a federal rule, so be it. But it isn't any sort of a concerted, sneaky-up effort to get the federal rules. I think that's a very important factor, and I wanted to emphasize that. And, of course, more than that, as Judge Beatty pointed out, the committee's chief goal would be to see the council bill passed so that we don't have to come to you with these things that, although we sincerely believe they are improvements, they are piecemeal. But until a council bill is passed, we've got to be here with these piecemeal improvements. I would add to what Burl said, the jury seeing the pleadings, it may be a little overemphasized in some attorneys' minds. Well, these words, I'm sure, will influence a jury, but Irving Younger, who gave some fine speeches, said, remember, if a jury hears something once, they won't remember it. If they hear it twice, they might remember it. Three times, they'll definitely remember it, and if it's in writing, it's the Holy Gospel. And I think that's what we're afraid of about the excessive language in pleadings. Some of the objections that have been made is that then what is the guideline that the jury will have? I think you should recognize that the judge can summarize the pleadings at the beginning, at the end of the trial. The jurors can take notes. And again, federal practice does provide a testing ground, and I have never heard anybody complain that, gee, I wish in federal court that they would have had the pleadings with them. Those are my additional thoughts on it to Burles.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gibbs.
Have you never had a case where the pleadings would be valuable to the jury? This means a complaint, answer, and this, all the basic first pleadings and everything, not only your most troublesome motion.
Well, of course, that's a very difficult question for me to answer. You never know what the jury does consider valuable after the case is all through. I have never felt that they were valuable. I feel that a trial lawyer should be able to explain the issues and why his side is better than the other side's on those issues than the pleadings. Now, you could say maybe from the plaintiff's standpoint, you'd like to have the prayer in the jury room so the jury can look at how much you're suing for. I don't think it makes that much difference because I think a good trial lawyer is going to write that on the blackboard anyway and ask the jury to write it down and take it in with them. I just think it would be so much saved by... You might lose a little bit. I just can't imagine where you are, but you might lose a little bit. But I just think there'd be so much saved by not worrying about the jury seeing this. Time spent in haggling out over language.
I'm certainly sympathetic with your motive of saving the money involved in the pleadings and making the motions and the answers and all this, but having served on the jury, that seems to me like we used some of the main things pretty extensively to kind of study the problem. And I'm not sure that the quality of justice would have been quite a bit. I don't know the question is raised in my mind whether the quality of our determination might have been as good had we not had those available as a matter of law.
That's certainly possible. I have not had that experience, so I really can't speak to that.
I'd much rather leave it. For instance, Mr. Chairman, if I can go one more point and I'll stop, I'd just much rather leave it in the hands of... Even if one of the parties would... let's say the parties would agree not that this shouldn't go, I wouldn't be nearly so disturbed. But to build into the law of prohibition against taking those pleadings into the privacy of the jury's consideration is kind of bothersome. It kind of reminds me of going to the doctor and saying, well, in language you'll understand, you know.
I don't know all the other jurisdictions, but I do know that in California they don't go to the jury, and in Washington they do not go to the jury. and I can't speak to any other jurisdiction.
Is it in the federal, is the federal rule?
Well, in the federal court, you have what the, Mr. Harris was referring to, is notice pleadings, which means it's a nothing pleading, and then after you spend many days and hours, you eventually develop a pre-trial order, which is a very complicated type of pleading.
They take away the pleadings, but make it worse.
But that doesn't go to the pre-trial order, doesn't go to the jury.
Oh.
Ted, which did you, in your experience as a juror, place more emphasis on?
It's not
the matter or the answer.
Well, it's not the matter of trying to overthink the problem, Mr. Kulongoski. Actually, I think it's helpful in helping me sort out what we were after. And it gets, some cases get pretty complicated, quite frankly, from the viewpoint of a juror. And it helped me kind of sort out what we were after and what had to be proven and so forth.
I analyze it as a cost-benefit type thing, Ted.
Yeah,
and there's benefits to be derived, but I think the cost, what it's costing us in the motion process, far exceeds whatever benefits that you may have from the jurors being able to sit and read the pleadings.
If I were convinced, Mr. Chairman, that you really would save a lot of fee money, I would have no trouble.
Chairman? Well, I think the expectation that practice would decline is a reasonable one.
I do.
Certainly the...
Mr. Chairman?
One
final consideration that had occurred to me as I was reading this legislation over, and I don't know if there's any basis in that court or not, but is there the danger, if you submit pleadings to a jury, that it will begin deciding issues of law rather than issues of fact? Because
well, we are submitting pleadings to the jury now.
Yes, I know, but I mean, is that not a potential danger, that the jury may be usurping the role of the judge with respect to a legal issue rather than a question of fact?
I mean, are they now?
Yeah.
I certainly couldn't answer that. I really don't know. I think most of the judges really try to make it very clear to the jury, your job is the facts. And I can't interfere with that. You can't decide law either. Mm-hmm. Using the trial attorney tries to make that pretty clear, particularly the law on his side.
Judge Beatty, would you like to come up? Well, thank you both.
Thank you.
We can take a break.
Gentlemen, I'm not the judicial conference has taken no position with respect to this measure, so I'm speaking in this stance purely as an individual. I want to make clear that I strongly support the position taken individually by the bar, taken by Mr. Green.
Excuse me, I'm having a little trouble here. Go ahead.
I do have an observation and a suggestion to make. First of all, I think it's pretty clear the bill will change, deleting this will reduce motion practice. It isn't going to solve the problems of elaborate motion practice, particularly where we have multiple parties and where we're getting more and more multiple parties and joiners, but at least it'll eliminate probably one round, particularly with some lawyers who keep wanting to keep one last word in and fighting over it. So I think it will result in a saving in that respect. I do, however, have a concern with respect to, particularly as cases get complicated. I'm talking about rear-end collisions. I don't think you need to send anything to the jury on a rear-end collision or an intersection collision, but the number of cases we have of those are so rare now that you see them once in a blue moon. In complicated cases, it seems to me it is desirable that the jury have with it some kind of a statement of the issues. Now, my own experience is that for 3 or 4 years now, I have instructed juries in both civil and criminal cases in writing every time. This is not the general practice. This is purely discretionary under the statute. And no one else likes it. None of the other judges are inclined to do it. I happen to do it and like it, and the juries seem to like it. But it does accomplish this. At least I simply state the issues. in describing plaintiff claims and defendant claims, and the lawyers have an opportunity to go over it and see whether or not they think it's fair. And in almost every case, I simply inquire, do you want the pleadings to go to the jury? And they usually always say no. I think in almost every case where I remember to ask them. My suggestion would be, particularly where you have multiple parties in complicated cases, that you add after, in line six, after the word deposition, language to this effect. However, the trial judge may, in his discretion, submit an impartial statement of the issues in writing to the jury. And I would contemplate that kind of a statement, and of course if it wasn't impartial, it would constitute, I don't think there's any question, it would constitute reversible error. That would enable the trial judge, in cases where he thought it was necessary to do that, as a practical matter, when the lawyers have been over it, there's very little likelihood that the trial judge cannot arrive at a statement as to which the lawyers will take no exception. He always has the option of not submitting it if he can't obtain agreement from them. But I think that might solve the problem that has been mentioned, and it would still accomplish the objective, which is to eliminate the preliminary motion practice over the first pleadings.
Representative Kieligowski.
Judge, do you have a copy of such a statement that you prepared for the jury?
No, I don't, Representative Kieligowski. I'd be happy to write a letter if you wish me to do so.
No, I would. I'd like to see it. And I guess my only concern about that, if we could have a uniform form that is consistent with all the jurisdictions, I may look at it a little differently. I'm a little concerned about having every judge have his own statement of what he believes is fair and impartial. I know that's a difficult question. It gets right to the heart.
He does it in every case to either a greater or lesser extent.
It's the opening statement, and they generally explain to the jury what they're here for.
Well, in the closing instructions, and in the closing, in oral instructions for a federal jury, now the plaintiff claims this and that, and omits most of the pleadings in the process of doing it. He's making a selective statement.
Green, do you have any comment on that proposal?
Mr.
Down, either one of you.
I can't speak for the committee because that was not discussed in the committee, to my recollection. Maybe Merrick remembers.
I personally had no objection to it because, as I say, as Judge Beatty says, it's done now orally. I don't approve of the written instructions going to the jury. Personally, it's just a personal opinion, but. I would not disapprove of a written summary of the issues going to the jury.
Representative Kieligowski.
You don't think that there's any problem as far as impartiality about preparing something like that?
Well, I tend to believe that most of the judges are going to try the best they can to be fair, and if you find some guy that gets kooky here, you just have to ask the Davis of prejudice.
I would assume most judges would permit the parties to review it anyway, wouldn't they? A comment or not? You wouldn't think so.
Particularly if it's in writing, because then it's then both lawyers can get a look at it in advance. You see, it's when he's just shooting from the hip off the bench.
Judge, as you say, you would expect them to permit the parties to the counsel to review it.
I would,
yeah,
because why? One thing judges, just as a class, don't like is being reversed. The one thing they want to be sure of is that they don't lay themselves open to being reversed on something like that. And it's so much simpler to let everyone look at it so that if there's anything wrong in what you said, why the lawyers can draw your attention to it.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Gardner.
Do you think that we might be increasing the number of appeals if we did this? And that's one question. And the second one when you talk about an impartial statement of the issues, are you envisioning something along the lines of your written instructions, or are you envisioning something else?
No, I'm simply, first of all, I don't think it would, I think if anything, it would eliminate issues to be appealed, because it will take, in 99 cases out of 100, as I indicated before, both lawyers having looked at it will say, I think it's fine except for that sentence, and, you know, you look at that and you think, well, I see your point, we'll change it this way, and the other fellow says, well, all right, it's okay. The issue's gone, there's not even an exception. With respect to what you do, for example, you would simply say the plaintiff claims in this case, in a simple case, the plaintiff claims that the defendant was negligent in the following particulars, which caused the accident and resulting injuries. And then you say the defendant denies that he was negligent and in turn claims that the plaintiff was in the following particulars, which caused the accident. And you've got the liability as the problem in that case. You've got the issues laid out, and the jury doesn't go fishing either on negligence or contributory negligence in areas that aren't actually the claims. And it, particularly if you've got multiple parties, as we so often are beginning to get now, products liability, it becomes a very intricate thing. The jury, we generally try those cases generally go to the jury, not on the usual form of verdict. I'm sure Mr. Green can supplement this, but you almost always end up with what we call a special verdict, in which the issues are laid out. Maybe 8 or 10 questions are put to the jury, dealing with different parties and different issues. And because we have to get agreement in order to use that in lieu of a verdict, that's what we normally have. We have a conference at which we agree on what the form of the verdict will be. So that's what I have in mind.
Further questions? Mr. Brownson?
Judge, would you run through that suggested language again? The statement, however the trial judge...
May I hand it to you right now? Save the committee time.
Fine.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you. 2256, Mr. Dunn.
Chairman, committee members, again, my name is Donald Dunn. I'm from the Dalles. I'm a member of the Procedure and Practice Committee, and here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2256 would eliminate the need of verification from pleadings. As you know now, pleadings are the complaint, answer, and reply. I think a demurrer is technically a pleading, but specifically by statute does not have to be verified. Verification, as you know, constitutes a sworn statement by the party, with only certain exceptions, that he believes it to be true. Now, subscription, as we propose it here, would be merely a signing of the document, and that could be either by the attorney or the party. The present practice out in my country, at least, can make a real problem. You've got a party who you need to have verify a pleading, and he may be in Condon, and maybe the action is filed in Condon. I'm drawing the pleading in the Dalles. So I have to mail it out to him, and he has to some way, during some business hours, find a notary public. And that may mean even some time off from work, or it may mean a trip into the Dalles for me to verify it, or one of my secretaries. And this hardship and inconvenience is certainly nothing that would be offset by any advantage that now exists. The usual hue and cry, especially the salty old trial attorney, is, oh, no, I'm going to impeach that dude with this thing. He signed it, and I'm really going to get him on the stand if he says something different. Well, the witness party will usually say, well, my attorney drew this up. That's a lot of legal gobbledygook anyway. And for that matter, there is an Oregon case which holds that a party may be impeached in a prior inconsistent statement in a pleading verified by his attorney and not by him personally. I think there was some background that was brought out in a prior hearing that for the rule that exists now, in that it would prevent attorneys from helter-skelter going around and filing pleadings, complaints for people who are not their clients. I don't think that's a very realistic fear in this day and age of rigid controls of attorneys' practices. I believe that's the gist of the bill and the reasons behind it, and I would welcome any questions you might have.
I'd like to ask if the this, of course, would be analogous to the federal practice.
Yes.
Is the statement here of the effect of the subscription, that is what it constitutes, is that language in any way parallel to the federal language?
It's exactly the federal language.
It is?
Mm-hmm. It constitutes, the subscription constitutes a certification by the party signing that it is true and in good faith. I would point out, too, that the federal practice has long been subscription only by the attorney is all that's necessary, and I have yet to hear any attorney saying, I sure wish we would have had verification by the party in federal court. I have never heard that said to me or by anybody, that it was said to them.
Is this any different from the bill which we sent to oblivion in the Senate last session?
Again, there's only one gentleman up there that stopped this bill, just as the other bill about the pleadings going to the jury. Later.
But is this bill the same as the one we passed two sessions, the last session?
Yes.
Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Rutherford?
Why aren't these bills initiated in the Senate? So it's all this problem.
They're magic.
Yeah, why are we wasting our time? Representative Fillmore?
May seem a silly concern, but it's, I used to be in a firm that represented some rather unpopular defendants, and one of the defendants with concerns was because they were so big and unpopular that someone would file a lawsuit against them and immediately issue a press release, and of course that was bona fide news report of pleading and be absolutely privileged in defamation laws. And there was some concern then that the requirement of verified pleadings acted as a protection against the sloppy or deliberately sloppy and overbroad use of inflammatory language in the pleading, really designed for the purpose of creating a press furor rather than trying a case before a court. That acted on a break on attorney's practice so far as I know, and I wonder whether you think that's a concern here.
It's a new thought to me, but it doesn't strike me as a real concern, Representative Frohmeyer. It's my understanding that whoever makes a statement is going to be liable for it, and if it's the attorney, he will be, and if he's acting as an agent, so will his principal be. And again, there is the certification or the to the effect that he believes it to be true and in good faith. Am I missing the point? It's a new...
Well, it is a concern, I guess I have generally, that with the relaxation of the verification requirement, that it might encourage more sloppy lawyering in the drafting of the precise nature of allegations, for example.
I certainly, it wouldn't me. I would want the same standard in all my pleadings, and that's as good as I could make them.
Representative Buis.
Question. I'm not so sure the witness, Mr. Chairman, maybe you. Would a subscription of this type be, if your pleading were, if you could demonstrate falsity, let's say, in the pleading, would then a subscription of the type that we would change to under this act bear upon proper charge of being a charge of false swearing?
It couldn't be false swearing, no. However, I think it could lead to contempt of court.
The subscription on a pleading constitutes a certificate by the person signing that he has read the pleading with the best of his knowledge, information, belief. There is good ground to support it, and it is not interposed for purposes of harassment or delay.
You lose that feature then, don't you, by not having a verification? Is that the improper verification subject to the charge of false swearing? Or are we getting a little further beyond it? We had a bill the other day, and we changed the caliber of penalty on false swearing, suborning witnesses.
It's my understanding, although I'm not strong on criminal law, that the false swearing or even perjury is a pretty tough thing for the district attorney to prove in any event. However, you might consider that the minute that party who did have his attorney subscribe, as soon as that party gets on the stand, he is under oath, and he will have to state in greater detail than ever facts which will either be true or false, and if they're false, he'd be subjected to the penalty.
Further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Brock.
Could you give us the number of the federal rule that the language on line 23 and following is taken from? You said it was taken from the federal rule.
I don't have
Patrick, do you know the answer?
Federal rule 11.
Further questions? Thank you very much. We have a number of bills that have been requested as committee bills. I'd like to take a 5-minute recess and then we'll just run through those and see if there are any. Other than the one requesting rescission of the Oregon Statehood Admission Act, I don't think there's anything in here. Committee will come to order. The remaining item of business is to consider and, if the committee feels appropriate, authorize the introduction of committee bills of a number of bills that I think we have here on the table. For purposes of maintaining a record, we've been going pretty fast these past few days, and I think our staff's having a little trouble. I'd like to ask the members to give the LC number when you read out the summary, so that the staff can make a note of that for purposes of having a record of the bill. I won't expect them to get the summary down, but the LC number should be sufficient. Dennis?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like a little bit of clarification. What does the staff need to do in addition to having it on the tape in a minute? Is there any action necessary by the staff?
No, I personally sign and file them with the clerk, so all the minutes need to do is just have a string of numbers as approved or disapproved. I'd like to urge the committee to exercise as much self-control as possible. We spent nearly half an hour yesterday on the matter of the introduction of what I admit was a fairly controversial bill, but I'm sure we all have things to do, and I'd like to say, unless you have just some resounding objection, these are somewhat more in the routine of the sorts of bills we're encountering here, except for the one about the rescission of the Statehood Act. That may be a problem, but okay, LC 10.
You say with a weakened vote, it's a majority opinion of the committee.
Yes. Let me just start reading through them, and if there's anybody who wants to stop and talk about it, just let me know at that point, okay? LC 1029-1 allows insurance commissioner to issue legal services insurance license without license examination to persons who hold other specified insurance agent licenses. This is a bill Stan Bunn has asked, former Representative Stan Bunn has asked the committee introduce. Okay, this next one is at the request of Multnomah County, limits the validity of a concealed weapons license to the county where it was issued.
No.
I'm sorry. This doesn't have an LC number. Limits the validity of a concealed weapons license to the county where it was issued and establishes a new system for issuing concealed weapons permits which are valid in more than one county. And this is at the request of Multnomah County. Next one is also at the request of Multnomah County, no LC number, permits corrections officers who act as court guards to carry concealed weapons without the permit required in ORS 166.250. That would be at the request of Multnomah County. It's an elections bill. So it elections bills have gotten in here.
Yeah, I noticed that. I was going to ask you about that. But.
Yes. What's this one? Abolishes the Republican Party.
They have a self-destruct
party. This one is at the request of the Mental Health Association of Oregon, LC 1846. Authorizes spouses and certain medical or psychological professionals to testify in commitment hearings without consent of spouse, client, or patient. Specifies day limits for conducting commitment hearings as judicial days. Allows court to take judicial notice of prior proceedings in same court about same person when mental illness alleged.
That was a request of whom?
It's a request of the Mental Health Association of Oregon. Next one would be a committee bill, but I don't have a request. I think it probably was developed by several sources. I believe the ACLU may have had a hand, perhaps a public defender, I'm not sure. It's LC 2016, prohibits impeachment of credibility of adverse witness by evidence of particular wrongful acts except as specified. Allows judge upon certain conditions to admit evidence of conviction of felony involving dishonesty or false statement to impeach credibility of adverse witness. Prohibits use of evidence of conviction of felony involving dishonesty or false statement to impair credibility of defendant in criminal proceeding unless defendant first introduced evidence supporting his credibility.
That nailed it, right?
That was introduced last time.
Yeah, something along the same line. Maybe in the very same bill.
Obviously didn't change.
Yeah, I don't think that I would commit
it. LC 1632, at the request of the Associated General Contractors, change of time, I would supply materials for which a construction lien may be claimed must give delivery notice to owner from 10 days after delivery to 45 days after delivery. Declares additional delivery notices to mortgagee are not required for subsequent deliveries. Declares person who performs labor on and furnishes material for an improvement need not give a delivery notice to mortgagee to obtain priority for his lien over recorded mortgage. This next one is also one which I think there have been several parties in the hand, ACLU and others. It's LC 2019, modifies provisions governing access to medical records, provides remedies, allows prevailing party attorney's fees, allows punitive damages for intentional violation of the act. I think there was a similar bill introduced last
that
session.
You own your own medical records bill?
Yes, I think that's essentially it. Next one is LC 2063. It exempts district court from writ of review procedures. And I think this is an offshoot of the District Court of Record Act from last session. It's a defect that we got coming through some work by different district judges, including Phil Abraham in Portland. Why all my other bills are in here? Next one is LC 1283, requires use of comma before, quote, or, unquote, or, quote, and, unquote, in Oregon laws, Oregon administrative rules, and Oregon revised statutes. Specifies procedures for inserting punctuation in existing laws and rules.
What
are the penalties? This is a bill that actually passed the Senate last session.
What are the penalties for violation?
This is made a capital offense conditioned on the approval of the constitutional. Pardon?
Who's asking that?
It's back as a committee on judiciary bill, and it's I can't remember. It seems to me it came from a private attorney.
It was in a newspaper the other day. I can't remember either. There was an article on it.
What is that?
It's a bill I think Senator Howard sponsored last session.
Yeah, but is it valid? I mean, can't we? Are we considering not dropping some of these?
Sure.
I move we don't.
So we haven't moved on any of them yet. Is
yeah, we're just kind of getting.
You want that list pulled out, Ted? Yeah, I suggest.
Next one is a bill, I believe it was introduced last session in somewhat similar form. LC 1731 establishes, quote, writs of garnishment, unquote, as alternative process of court to enable judgment creditors to subject to payment of his judgment property or indebtedness owing by garnishee to judgment debtor. Establishes, quote, writs of garnishment, unquote, as alternative process of court court to enable plaintiff creditor before judgment to subject to payment of his claim, property, or indebtedness owing by garnishee to defendant debtor.
That's pretty tough. Credit unions of them.
Who sponsored that one?
Someone hadn't read the Snyder's.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Okay. Any objections to the admission of those as committee bills?
All
of
them.
Pull out the punctuation one for a moment. The order. Now, what about the punctuation one? Can you have a strong objection to introducing it?
You passed
it last time, as I said.
Yeah,
well,
that's a common
just don't fall into the same trap.
What's the problem?
I think apparently it is an effort to clarify the meaning of statutes where there are certain constructions used.
You had a problem.
Without any testimony, I don't know.
Yeah, there's been a problem.
So then must have some testimony.
Okay.
Any objection?
I don't care.
Order.
I guess I won't look at it.
Fourth right.
Fine. That's fine.
Mr. Chairman. Judge George Cole, a former member of the Southwest Group, has asked that he be permitted to drop one in. He's going to give it to me this weekend, and it's all piped up and backed and ready to go. And if the committee has any problems with it, I'll drop in myself. But he asked if we would concern it.
What's it about?
He said it makes the district court, of which he is judge, more like unto the circuit court. I don't know what that means.
Can you do the introduction copies? Are there any other members who have bills they wish to request as committee bills?
I don't have it here. I don't know what Dennis's time is like, but legislative council is absolutely non-compass medis at this point, and they can't take anything else. I'd like a bill to abolish the freeholder requirement for membership on the boards of directors of soil and water conservation districts, which I think is flat-out unconstitutional, but is currently a requirement of statutory law.
Representative Frommeyer moves the committee request the drafting of a bill with the effect described as a committee bill. I think, Dennis, you can contact and get an L.C. Dummerin jacket set up on it, and he can pursue it later. If we have the request in now, it just takes the speaker's authorization to file a bill when it's ready after Monday as a committee bill. Any objection to that motion? Ordered. Further requests? For the business. Adjourned on Monday, 1:30. We'll be at the work session.
Those are the freeholder requirements for membership on the water conservation chapter.